Hello there. I'm Ruth McKee, editor of Books Ireland, and joining me for this next episode of Burning Books is author Ronan Hessian. Now, most of you will know him as the author of the much-loved Leonard and Hungry Paul, or perhaps Panenka, both award-winning novels published by Blue Moose Books. Well, he has a new novel out called Ghost Mountain, quite different from his first two, so I began asking him just how he approached writing this novel. I can see why a translator would absolutely love your writing. There's so much breath and there's so much clarity to it. It's so beautifully economic, but
thank you.
It's just so much in it. I'm so jealous. Like, how do you do it? How do you make it? You make it look so easy as well, which is hard to do. Can I ask you really, before we start, just a really horrible kind of mundane question, but did you write it in a linear way? Did you have a plan, or, you know, did it evolve, or did you have character sketches, or did it like...
Basically, I know that I'm sort of pregnant with the book, if you like, when I start getting these sort of flashes, and it's just a sort of a deposit of sort of creative energy that I just know it's sort of book-sized. So that's enough, and I have some images, and usually there's a few separate threads that suddenly combine that make me... realize that it's sort of enough of an idea to get a book out of it. And there were many times during Ghost Mountain, like, where I met friends and said, "Is this just a boring book? Like, well, you know, what am I doing here?" But really, I sort of have this approach, a bit like when you're driving at night, you know, where the headlights show you the next bit, and you just trust that it's not a cliff after that, that there's more road, and you just have enough to go through. And I think there has to be, to be honest with you, I think to get at the edge of your writing, there has to be that jeopardy. There has to be that sense that you're not simply in execution mode. Because I think if I were to plot and just do, it'd be like colouring in a picture. It's just kind of purely the technical matter of filling out the structure. So I tried to really keep that spontaneity. Like, for example, the other books I'd written in bursts of 3 or 4 months, the first draft, like 10 at night to midnight, 6 nights a week for 3 months, 4 months. Whereas this one, I just worked on I rationed myself like 2 or maybe 3 writing sessions a week. And I always use something from that day, always from that. So to keep it spontaneous. So for example, if I were writing a chapter tonight, I would put a piano in it somewhere just to make sure that my brain was never sort of just in that execution mode. A big influence on Ghost Mountain was, during the pandemic, I was working from home, so my eyes would get tired because I do a lot of reading in my work, so I couldn't print anything off. So I used the read aloud function of Microsoft Word, which is like karaoke. It kind of bounces across the screen, and it's easier on your eyes, and your retention is much better actually when you use that. But then I started using it in my creative writing, and I also changed computer. So I had this particular voice on my new computer, Junior, who's like a sort of 10-year-old nasal American accent. So he kind of talks like, "Ruth is on Zoom. Ruth has a piano. Ruth plays her piano. Ruth plays her piano well in tune." So it kind of talks. So I wrote for Junior's voice. Every time I was writing, I just wrote for Junior. And that kind of gave me the sort of rhythm of the story, you know. But yeah, no, I do believe in it's spontaneous, but it's spontaneous in the sense, like, you know, you go on holidays for the day and you're in Paris or something. You're like, "I'd like to see the Louvre. I'd like to get dinner somewhere nice. I'd like a bit of a walk." Other than that, I'm kind of flexible. The order we do it and what happens in between. So I have that sort of approach. It's not a complete winging it. I know there's something there, and it's more a question of working towards it, really.
But that makes sense to me as well, that kind of intrigue of your own intellect, really, and your own imagination. There's that sort of thread that you kind of tug on. It's nice. But also, I really love that you use something from each day, or that there's that, because there are... How do you hang on to those? Because there are those moments, like you're walking around, you notice something, and you kind of go, "Oh," and there's that little, I don't know how to describe it, that moment or that, you know, fragment of something in your reality that you kind of, if it's a tenderness or if it's a pain or if it's a sadness or whatever it is, and you kind of want to, but usually forget or it dissipates, and then by the time you're sitting down, it's gone. So do you grab it? Do you note it down, or do you just remember?
No. I trust that anything kind of good has a kind of natural buoyancy to it. I think to some extent there's in writing, I often think about the phrase art form, and I think there's the art and then there's the form. You know, and a lot of time in writing, people talk about the form, the technical business of writing, getting it through. But actually connecting with the art bit, which is kind of a, it's kind of a paradox, because on the one hand, if you apply the rules of productivity to it, it closes up like a flower. If you apply the rules of laziness to it, it naturally gives you stuff. So to some extent, when it gives you these little bits, and if you really bring your productivity sort of mindset to it, it kind of shrinks back. So I think my approach has always been that when I sit down, I might forget some of those, and maybe something amazing will slip by me. But in general, the flow is stronger when you're not panicking that you're leaking lots of good ideas. And I think that's central to, and maybe that comes from my background in music, you know, I think that's helped me see it that way, that I don't hang on to things that much. You just kind of get in tune with them and trust that the flow, and it could shut up shop anytime. That happened to me with music, really. Like, I moved away from music because I didn't feel there was any juice there anymore. So I'm reconciled to the fact that I could be orphaned by my own, imagination at some stage. But, you know, as long as you just accept that, then it's quite freeing, actually, really.
And so there's a kind of, not playful, not in the kind of trivial sense, but a playfulness of spirit, like a playfulness of spirit, or a kind of, yeah, you said accepting, like you accept whether the music's there, you accept whether it's not, or if it's into that kind of, I know what you mean. I know that when you talked about juice, or the kind of when you're being pregnant with a book, that sort of anticipation or kind of excitement, not quite excitement, but you know there's an engine sort of there that you just kind of want to have it ticking over.
And you get it as a reader as well. I think, you know, I can read a book and I'll go, this is very well done, it's very cleverly done, but there's no juice in here. There's nothing, there's no bells ringing inside me at all. There's no, I'm not, this is not a decision that I've decided to connect or not connect with. It's like, this was written from a technical standpoint. Somebody had a premise. They know enough about writing to develop that and deliver it. But there's no real source there. It's written from a, it could still be a good book, you know, by all accounts. But you're sort of, sometimes you put it down afterwards, you think, what was that missing? It seemed to be perfect, but it was missing something, and it was the juice, basically. The person was smarter than the reader, just enough to impress them, but not enough to really get into that special zone, you know.
Do you think that's something? It's something in Ghost Mountain that I really like, is one of the characters talks about being an old soul, but also being a new soul. And I was kind of wondering what that's like as a reader and a writer as well. You know, sometimes you can really sense when you're reading an old soul, you know.
Well, Acho, is it, and Ruth?
I think, yeah, I know. And I was like, oh, it's Ruth. There's a character called Ruth. I was very impressed. Great name choice.
Yeah, I like the name Ruth. I like it. It's a sort of biblical name, but it's also a word. Ruth is mercy, you know, as you probably know. You probably have fridge magnets and stuff to tell you that. I was working with a guy in work, and he was telling me, because we often encounter, and there's also generational change in work, and you notice generational differences. And he was telling me about, this is a common thing, I didn't invent old souls, young souls, this is a common sort of folk sort of thing. And he explained to me what it was, you know, an old soul is someone who kind of, you know, they're just more settled. But I just tried to extend it down, the idea of it's a soul that's been around thousands and thousands of times. So in other words, the universe and the person is kind of interchangeable. And a young soul is one where they're still trying to shape the world around them. And you know, the difference in perspective, once you understand that, you can't, there's not, lifetimes are not long enough to change a person that much. It's a kind of a very slow process. So, but I think it was kind of a helpful way of just, you know, Ruth, the character, this is a couple, Acho and Ruth. And Acho's kind of, he kind of reminds me of a lot of kind of harmless but slightly annoying men that get kind of in trouble on the internet, where they kind of don't know who they are, really. And one of the common threads in Ghost Mountain is that we carry around this uncertain and slightly disguised or hidden sense of self inside us. And so what we do is we project it into the world to have it validated. And of course, the world doesn't care or notice. So we're left in this intermediate state. We've projected this self into the world saying, what have I got here? And the world says, nobody cares. So it's all the characters are to some extent trying to do that externalizing, and the Ghost Mountain itself is an object of projection for them. And I think Ocho is like a lot of these guys, young guys I see, where they're kind of, they have full-size bodies, and they may even have jobs and, you know, family responsibilities, whatever. But that sense of self is in a very early stage. So what they put out into the world is kind of a second guessing what the world expects of them. And it leaves them really exposed and vulnerable. And like all humans, when they feel that way, that they behave in unpredictable ways.
There's a character as well at the, I actually nearly stopped reading at the very beginning of the book. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to tell listeners, so I can edit this out if I'm not allowed to tell readers. But I do have a thing about dogs. I love dogs.
Yeah.
Deeply. And I love my dog very much. And I often, when I'm watching films, you know, I do that. You know, the website that does the dog die. And right at the beginning of Ghost Mountain, there is a tragic scene.
That's it. Well, it's a tragic. This is the thing, right? And you're only halfway through. So ask me that question again when you're finished.
Oh, good. Okay.
No, sorry, there isn't some plot development that's going to ease
there's no. Answer, right? Okay, so there's no resurrection going on.
No, absolutely. If anything, there's a wall of death still to come, right? But the point about that, well, first of all, you see animal grief becomes a very real defining feature for Elaine, the character. She maybe not even be Elaine.
She's not Elaine yet, no.
Yeah, so she'll become Elaine. And one thing that I'm trying to look at in the book, I'm trying to look at life with a capital L, right? As opposed to life, you know, Ruth's life, Ronan's life. So you can look at life as lots of different people having lives and deaths, or you can just look at life as one thing that's continually reconfiguring itself. A bit like the way a kaleidoscope works, where you have the same beads reorganizing themselves into different patterns. That's not something you can observe within a lifetime, but you observe characters over a long period of time, and you learn, observe lots of different characters, you start to see life reoccurring in the same way waves in the shore, you know, it's the same water just coming back in different ways. So you need to have a bit of that. And I wanted to write about death in a way, because often I think death is written about as a tragic thing, or it's kind of a little poignancy shortcut. You know, it's like a little extra spoon of sugar in the novel. And I wanted to write about it in a real way. I'm almost 50. You know, I've had both my parents are dead. People in my life have died. We had a miscarriage. You know, my son's friend died. You know, I've seen it. So to some extent, death is much more complex and it's deeper than purely a sad ending for a character. So it's important to show that. So I know, I'm sure I'll get a lot of stick over that, but it's important to the book to show that, yeah.
No, I did. I like, you know, when she's, yeah, I don't want to go too much into it because I don't want to spoil it for people. But you have such a light touch with such sort of profundity so easily and so wittily that I'm, and your chapters are brief and limpid and just, I could gobble it up. Basically, I read this afternoon. I'm halfway through. I'll probably finish it tonight. You hear this all the time, so you probably don't need to hear anyone else saying how brilliant you are.
No, do keep that in the interview, by the way. You're spicy. Cut out the other bits, but that bit you should keep.
I'm going to have to ask you about some books, Ronan, bring you back a bit. And it's great because I love seeing books I haven't come across before, and lots of these I haven't at all. A couple of them I have, but I want to ask you a little bit about what you were like when you were a child, what kind of boy you were like, what you were like as, I don't know, an 8 or 9 year old at school. Did you read? Were you into books? What were you like?
When I was born, right, I was a rhesus baby, right? So that, I don't really know what that means, but I had to have a blood transfusion, right? And so I didn't come home immediately. I have a twin sister, so my sister came home. I didn't come home for a couple of days. And I was really, because I was so hyper as a child, my father told me that when I got my blood transfusion, I got Gary Glitter's blood. And I remember going in and telling my teacher this completely seriously. And she said to my parents, "That's Ronan, got Gary Glitter's blood." And they were like, "Oh, God, because they had told me the story a couple of years before. So I was a very lively child. So I played football. I'd get up in the morning. I'd play football for 4 hours, come in, eat 2 jam sandwiches, go out and play football for another 4 hours, come back and have 2 more jam sandwiches, and I'd have another football for another 4 hours. And then I'd lie awake in bed. I was a very active child, and I wasn't really much of a reader. The first books I got into, and my first one I got was from my Holy Communion. My older brother, I'm from a family of 8 children, right? I was the 7th. If I give my sister, she was 20 minutes before me, so I have 1 younger brother. And my eldest brother is 12 years older than me. So he was my godfather, and he bought me an Asterix book. You know, these Asterix, I suppose you'd call them, they're kind of kids' graphic novel types, I suppose, and they're cartoons, but they're kind of book length. And I used to love those. I still have them all upstairs, and, you know, every Christmas and birthday and special occasion, my brother Michael would buy me those. And when I think about it, right, this is kind of not true, but if, you know, for the purposes of trying to draw spurious connections for an interview, like, it's translated, and it's kind of about an outsider, you know. And I kind of have always favored outsider perspectives. I'm on a small publisher, you know, I follow bad football teams, you know. I've always much preferred being in the underdog position, rather than being the sort of chosen, you know, following the obvious path to success. And that's a personality thing, just because I'm just awkward or whatever. But also, I think it's an independence thing, you know, that if I was given the choice where someone said, you can just have the success handed to you, or you can have a fraction of the success and earn it yourself, you know, I wouldn't feel comfortable just getting it for its own sake. So there were early sort of signs there. And then when I was in secondary school, I started going to the swimming pool up in Northside, in Coolock. And I used to go, I joined the library there. And it was great because it was the first time, I think, in my life where as a child, you could go in, get something under your own name, you know, get a book under your own name. Because I was used to, I'm still like this, actually. When I was a kid, every time I went to Arden Castle Shopping Centre, the security guards were like, and I always kind of felt like I'm not, and even now, you know, I'm in a good job and I'm a grown up. I still always get a receipt, you know, when I'm in the self-service things. I'm always afraid somebody's going to accuse me of stealing something. I've never stolen anything in my life. It was really strange to me. I could go in, hand in something, someone would give me a book, and if I wanted, I could run away to Vegas with the book and they wouldn't stop me. But I'd come back, so I'd go swimming the next week, and I would want to have the book finished to get a different book. And so one by one, but I read kind of indiscriminately. And then obviously when I got assigned novels in secondary school, that got me into a reading habit. And my brother, who's a priest, was studying English in UCD. So he had a big box of books under his bed. And I remember reading, I was like, I think in third year or something, I was reading, oh no, fifth year, I think, I was reading the Beckett trilogy, you know, Malloy, Malone Dies, your name, without knowing anything about Beckett. Beckett had just died, I think. He died when I was around that age. And I remember a guy in my class saying to me, are you studying triology? It was great that I did. There wasn't, my eldest brother was a big reader of history. My priest brother was not around because he went off studying to be priest. And so I just picked up stuff, and I did get a reading habit in secondary school. Yeah, I used to like in lunchtimes, if it was a wet day, I'd go in the library and read. There was a few of us who would like try to read 50 pages a day. That was our big thing, 50 pages. And my commute, because I went to O'Connell's in the city centre where my brothers are gone and where my mother used to live. So it was like a bit of a bus journey. So that was my reading time, and then a bit of bed. And that's kind of where I am now. I still kind of have a sort of 50 a day guy, you know, that's still my sort of general rule.
I'm absolutely fascinated that your older brother was a priest. But you said he was off doing that. So that there was no influence there. You didn't have any kind of sort of spiritual awakening around that time or anything like that.
No, I always got in trouble because from a very early age, I was an atheist, openly an atheist. Now, my mother wasn't, she was more concerned about how I'd be treated in the afterlife. So it wasn't that she was like, you must conform to the church and that kind of stuff. It was more, she was genuinely concerned, you know. And but I was saying things to her like, if you were in India, you wouldn't be a Catholic. You know, you wouldn't be the only Catholic in your big Indian family. And, you know, are you telling me that if I didn't do my confirmation, I wouldn't have whatever the gifts of the Holy Spirit, you know, patience or whatever? Are you really, has that been tested? Like, have they lined up kids who have and have not got the gifts of the Holy Spirit? And can they? And my mother would just say to my brother, you talk to him.
You talk. Of course, your siblings had an influence on me, but did they influence your reading, do you think, or your choices?
I don't think so. Like, I'm from a family of eight, and like my, I said, my eldest brother, was a reader, but not a fiction. It was a priest. So priests, you know, they're quite well educated. He did it, and he did it in English and stuff. But no one else in my family is a reader, really. And there weren't that many books in our house. The books I remember in the house were like Wilt, which every house had, and by Tom Sharp, and is just, you never see it anywhere, right? But every house seemed to have a compulsory copy of Wilt back then. I don't even know what it's about. There was a copy of Spike Milligan, Adolf Hitler, My Part in His Downfall. There was a book called The Night It Rained, which I actually included in Leonard Hungry Paul, which is kind of a cop, a police crime novel. And the whole thing hangs on whether you pronounce it Z or Z. Anyway, that's the spoiler on that. And but other than that, we didn't really have many books, and we weren't a reading household. It was two families, really, four older ones, four smaller ones, and the four smaller ones, none of us read. We had, like, if you were in Blyton on tape, we would listen to at bedtime, but we didn't read, and it was never a big deal, actually, whether we read or not. Nobody really was suggesting it as a way to spend time, really.
Yeah. And so I know that you didn't start writing to quite a lot later on, did you? But did, or at least as far as I know from what I know about you, did you have any sort of, was that when music started for you then, like to like playing music and being in the band, did it start then, or was that later too, like before? Did you go to college? Sorry, Ronan, I don't know.
I went to Trinity. I did politics and economics. I actually, when I was seven, I wrote a book, and it seems crazy that I didn't think about being a writer, but I wrote a book called Sandy Sailors, a kind of adventure story ripoff thing. And I wrote the whole thing. I wrote it on summer holidays, and my teacher got me to read it chapter by chapter to the class. You know, so I'd read a couple of chapters one day, and then next week I'd read a few more. And then I read it for another class. Another teacher had heard about it. And then I kind of never did anymore. I wrote some, like, teenage poetry as well. I remember sending, like, I don't know, maybe a little stack of like 75 handwritten teenage poems to the Irish Times. And it's almost like on the half volley, as soon as they got to me, sent them straight back with just like a little complimentary slip and a sort of restraining order, you know, attached. And so I said, okay, fuck that. I'm not reading again. I'm not writing again. You know, I'm not, either I want to be, you know, good at this or not do it at all, you know? So I didn't do anything then for years and years. And it started music in, my first gig was 93. I joined a band in 92. So I've been creatively active for over 30 years. Like, it's kind of pretty much unbroken. I was in bands, and then I started playing solo in the late 90s and when I was in college. And then started a small record label and put out the first album in 2002, second one 2007, and the last one in 2012, and that got shortlisted for the Choice Music Prize, the album of the year, and it was album of the year in the Independent, and it was album of the year and a couple of blogs and stuff, even though it was just like a tiny, just really me just putting it out. But that was quite a sad album. It was a lot about, you know, my father died when I was seven, so like my mother had eight children from age five to 19, like that's what you look after, and then she died in 2007. We had a miscarriage that year. And so I wrote a lot about my family and the strains of being a new parent. So partly Leonard and Hungry Paul is kind of a light book, because it's kind of, it's correcting for the sort of sad introspection of that album, really. When I was at college, I said, well, if I'm going to read, I should really study. So I did neither. But as a principle, I thought it was a good principle that I think the only book I read lots of music biographies at college. And I read, I think, High Fidelity about 10 times, maybe. And I remember I went out with a girl and she broke up with me and kind of broke my heart at the time. And then after we broke up, she gave me Beloved by Toni Morrison. And out of spite, I didn't read it. So I still my spite has lasted well. I have about 3 or 4 Toni Morrison books I haven't read. And if you're in the writing world, there's loads of writing advice about Toni Morrison. I'm always like, I'm not gonna take that advice either. Whatever the books, I'm not even taking the advice. I don't even want to know. So I have this grudge with Toni Morrison. I think she's dead now, but in my own time, I'll release my grip on that.
You need to let that go.
So I read, when I lived with friends in town for like, I don't know, 4 years, 5 years, and we went out and we had fun, and I read a bit there, but not that much. I started reading a few kind of more international books then. But then when I moved in with my wife, I had a quiet life, and I remember she bought, one day we went in and she bought Anna Karenina or Karenina, I never know how to pronounce it. And I said, okay, well, I'll do a big reading project too, you know. So I got Moby Dick, and the two of us read. That was like the official start of the reader I now am, because I basically spent 10 years reading Penguin classics then.
I was going to say, you basically both chose two books with amazing first lines.
Yeah, actually. And I actually kind of disagree with the, I've been interviewed about my disagreement with the opening line of Anna Karenina, because Leonard and RuPaul, I my argument is that Happy Families are not all alike. They are actually interesting. But both amazing books. And actually, we read a bit of Anna Karenina at our wedding. You know, so we read the bit, the wedding scene, or the preceding scenes, about the fact that Levin, the guy in the book, is completely faking it because he doesn't believe in God. So that actually would have been a more appropriate one for us to read. And then when I had kids, I didn't read much for about 5 years. The only things I read, where I read a lot of those Granta themed collections. They really got me through. I read Anne Enright edited one called Are We Related? And then there was one themed on fathers, one themed on siblings and mothers. So I read a lot of that sort of stuff.
Were you not sleeping? Is that kind of time when your children are tiny and are just exhausted?
Yeah, I didn't really read novels again until maybe my kids were, my youngest guy, they're 13 and 15 now, but when my younger guy was about 5, I think I started. And I've been talking to a few people recently, actually, who have very young kids, because I was giving one bookseller in Dublin. She has young children. And she'd asked for proof of Ghost Mountain. So my last spare proof, I gave it into her. I said, with my blessing, if I meet you in 6 months and you haven't read it, it's fine. You know, because she sort of feels bad being in a bookshop, which you can't keep up with the new releases. And it is really hard, you know. So
you had a sort of, I'm not going to say dearth, because it's a different, you're having a different kind of life in those years, aren't you? But yeah, a lot of people don't read, don't write, because your creativity is your children at that time, and your energy is your kids, and everything is just kind of keeping the boat on the water, isn't it?
Yeah, and you're kind of brain damaged, you know, you're so underslept, you know. I remember ringing up the DDoC and they were asking, okay, yeah, Miss Ashton, yeah, what's your son's date of birth? And I couldn't remember the year he was born. I knew the date, but I was like, I think it is 2000, because they're 2 years apart, but one's January of one and then November 2 years later. So it's like, that sounds like they're only a year apart, but I know they're 2 years apart. And I said, I am, ask me something else. I can tell you it's PBSM, but just, I can't. But you know, and a lot of the memories from that period are just, they're all jumbled. They're in there, but I don't know what year in it, or like which vaccines they had, or, you know, we've written down somewhere, but it's a really tough time. And I think for writers, it must be very difficult, you know, if you have children and you're trying to, because creativity is energy, really. You know,
it is.
That's what it is. And if you don't have that.
But it comes back. It comes back. So, I mean, at what point then did you kind of, writing and reading wise, I suppose, outside of those, coming out of those years, like, was there a particular kind of, I'm reading again, I'm properly reading again, or I'm starting to, you know, things are starting to go outwards again.
I think when they were both in primary school and you were just doing one drop in the mornings, that was huge. Because when you're trying to do two drops, and at the time, my wife had taken a career break, you know, which was brilliant for, you know, the kids and for us all. But there was, like, we went from a stage of having two incomes for two people to one income for four people, you know, in a very, and that sort of, I felt quite a heavy weight of that, actually, you know. And you want to be, you're kind of, your family's at home and you're the one leaving them every day. And, you know, you sort of feel that. So I think when we got to primary school, we'd get a bit better handle on it, you know. And so I started reading again. I remember I really missed it, you know. And I think for some reason, people often think I read a lot, and I do, but writers do read a lot. And but I think one of the reasons is I'm probably compensating for, you know, I've had these periods when I was at college or when I was much younger or when the kids were young where I haven't read. So, you know, I've read a lot of 19th century and pre-19th century stuff. I've read a lot of 21st century stuff, and I'm kind of patchy on the 20th century.
Yeah, but you read a lot on translation, don't you? I know that from following you on social media. And what was that, a conscious thing that you began, that you thought, right, I want to read outside of the pond, or did it just find yourself?
It started a mix of things. Eileen Battersby was a big factor in it. I used to really enjoy reading her reviews, and she reviewed a lot of translated fiction, and that made me curious. And I suppose when you first start reading translated fiction, you kind of, there's two kind of forgivable entry mistakes. One is that you have kind of a Lonely Planet approach where you say, I'd like to know more about Croatia. Let's read a book about Croatia. And you kind of almost think it's the job of those writers to explain their country to you, which is a very understandable and actually completely fine thing to do. The other, I think, is that I just realized, I think, that it's kind of normal, you know, it's kind of weird not to include them. You know, in the same way, it's like if you had, you know, just Irish food every day, and you might think, oh, look at Fancy Pants, they're having a curry. Look at your man with his fusilli. Who do you think he is? He's really exotic. And I think you get to the point where you just eat all different cuisines. You don't even think about it. You don't make noodles and think, you know, look at me trying to, you know, really find out what it's like in the Far East. You're just going to eat them as noodles. And so translate, like, there's no subtitles. It's already in English. So there's actually zero extra effort. But the more I got serious about it and learned more about the actual importance of it, that, you know, there's quite a statistic I've used a lot, which is that 95% of the world's population, their first language is not English. So, and only about 5%, and it's growing a bit, closer to 10% of fiction sales are in translation. So you've 95% of the world crammed into 5 or 10%. So it's actually, it's not so much that I could kind of flip it and say, well, it's not so much that I'm giving so much attention to translated fiction. The question is, we should wonder ourselves, why are we shopping local so much in a way? And I've really, it's exposed me to not just perspectives from the world, but also I've learned a lot about writing from them. Because if you read it, like, there are certain conventions in Anglophone literature that we take as a given that are really not. They're really not. And throughout the world, they're ignored. That's not to say they're not valid, by the way. It's just that they are one approach. You learn from that approach, but you also realize there's a lot of things going on. It sometimes bothers me, actually, that the perspective that the Western way of doing things is the correct way, because it creeps into teaching and it creeps into reviewing, you know, where I see books getting criticized for not delivering a resolution, not having conflict, all those kind of things. When it's fine if the writer was trying to do that and didn't pull it off, but when a writer's not trying to do that, like, I think I've seen reviews of Chinese literature that kind of make that point. And I feel frustrated that it's a lack of educational understanding on the reviewer's part rather than a deficiency in the book they're reviewing. But hopefully that'll change over time.
Completely get that. And even, like, you know, the idea of even like in cinema where we're kind of used to the kind of three act or whatever, but like, what's the Japanese director's name, Ronan? It's three letters. Ozu. So, you know, whenever the narrative, it kind of just, it's like just throwing a stone in the water. And that's it, you know, and it's just all the ripples. And we're so used to, like, I remember the first one I watched, I was like, I don't know how to do this. But, you know, it's a great experience because it's completely at odds with how we've kind of been trained almost to view or to read. But, like, I know what you're saying about, and sorry, it seems to be quite a obtuse question to say, oh, why do you read books in translation? But
people ask a lot. Actually, I have a theory on that, just for what it's worth, that I think that the storytelling in the West is very influenced by the Bible. So that's why there's conflict and resolution, because people, there's an outcome. People are reformed or go to heaven or hell, and there has to be conflict in which the good is tested. You know, in the East, in Dharmic cultures, so whether it's Buddhist, Jainist, you know, every moment's important. And because there's belief in reincarnation or rebirth, which are slightly different things, that there isn't an ending. So the last page is not more important than page 50. Every page is important, equally important. And it's not a question of an outcome. It's the process is the point of it. And I think that seeps into the narrative. There's some quite interesting articles online about structure, even in different structures. There's a structure used in Chinese and Japanese literature called Kisho Tenketsu. It's resolution without conflict, basically, is what it is. And it's almost like where at the end of a book, a sort of light shines back through the story. So it's not so much that there's something satisfied at the end. It's like an illumination. So it's a different way of telling. So people who are bracing themselves for, oh, nothing happened, or, oh, I was still wondering about that. That's not the point, because strictly speaking, any of those books could go on forever.
It's kind of nice you have a publisher that recognizes what you're doing.
And it concerns me, right, that I don't get to, like, to some extent, you know, I don't look to pick fights on any of this stuff. I'm concerned that so many people are now seeking formal training in writing, which I think should be a good thing. But if what they're getting taught is either extremely biased towards one particular approach, mm-hmm. or if they're doing things that are genuinely creative and being corrected because of a lack of awareness on the part of the teacher. And a lot of the teachers are not widely published, or they're not that experienced. They're very early in their careers. Like if you got bad teaching advice from Claire Keegan, John Bamville, or, you know, an Enright, you'd say, well, look, they at least know what they you have to cross the forest many different types of ways to be able to give advice. So a lot of people just walked across the forest once, are kind of telling everyone, this is how you cross forests.
Yeah.
So I certainly don't feel I have the experience to teach anybody. But what so I think, especially we were starting out, lack confidence. And I think, well, you know what you're doing, so I believe you. So that's the bit that bugs me. Not so much how it affects me personally, because I feel I've been able to sort of bypass that in a way, just the way things worked out. But I can only imagine people who have been discouraged, people who are good writers who've been discouraged, and that I think is. That's really hard to think about.
Something I wanted to ask you about is rereading, Ronan, and if there's a book that you kind of dip in, you go back to, or it's just been with you for a long time, or that's just been along the journey with you, if you have a book like that in your life.
Yeah, I have a couple of books. Like I think poetry is great for that, you know. And one collection that I definitely revisit is City Works Department by Philip Hancock. Philip Hancock's a painter-decorator. He's from Stoke, lives in London. And he still works as a painter-decorator. And he writes a lot about that. But during the pandemic, I sort of kept that beside me almost like a child's blanket. You know, I kind of just would open it and read from it. And it's really lovely. If you want me, I can read a poem for it if you want.
Yes, please.
This one's called The Quiet Joiner. It's about a guy who just shows up hanging doors one day, right? He came to us at the halfway house, snipped moustache, overalls spotless, as his politely parked Volkswagen, to hang 15 SAPO fire doors in 3 days. We bet on his chances. 4 flights of narrow stairs, suspended ceilings, new lino, how not to mash his fingertips in the gunshot closers. After circling his car, lunch. Brown bread sandwiches, a tomato, pepper tapped from a pill bottle, proper time taken over each closed mouthful. The last day, glossing up, fucking flies, we're stripped to the waist, full blast Radio 1, coming in on the chorus. Him just stood there, returning the steel rule to his breast pocket. All done. The only time we heard him speak. So that's Philip Hancock. Beautiful. He has a lovely poem talking about when he was an apprentice and he sent off to buy the chips and peas and gravy and a chipper. And it's all his observations as he goes down. and all his observations as he comes back. And then the closing line of the poem, he brings it back to the foreman. Foreman looks in the bag and says, "One day, son, I'll teach you how to carry gravy." So you think it's going to be different poems. Oh, such beautiful observations, you know. And it's actually, keep your eye on the bloody gravy, you know, next time, daydreamer, you know. So it's lovely, lovely poems, you know. And I got to meet Philip in London recently, and he's was a wonderful, really talented writer. But, you know, people talk about how great Irish writing is, and it is. It's in a really, it's really hopping at the moment. But there are a lot of really great English writers as well, but they don't get anything like the support we get. And I'm not just talking about money, like even, you know, a lot of people I know in the UK, you know, they don't get reviewed, they don't get to literary festivals, they're never on the radio, they're not on podcasts, and they really get very little traction anywhere.
I wanted to ask you about Alan Bennett, because you've mentioned him here. Tell me why you'd save Alan Bennett from your Burning House. I have to mention the Burning House at some point. Yeah. We like just at least a token reference to the...
Yeah, I love Alan Bennett. You know, like, I think his memoirs about his parents, you know, writing home and whatever the other one is, and then his diaries, you know, which are published every year in the London Review of Books. They're, you know, I think he was a big influence on me around Leonard and RuPaul. I remember reading him and thinking, he just always knows what's interesting. You know, he can pick the interesting thing out of any given situation. And he writes, his sense of humor. And he's one of those writers, and they're quite rare, where you can only read it in his spoken voice. Like, once you've heard him speak, you know, you can only read it in Alan Bennett's voice. I believe, like, I also love David Hockney, you know, the painter David Hockney. And Alan Bennett's from Leeds and David Hockney's from Bradford. And they both are the same age, and they both still have their hair, and they both wear unnoticeable glasses. And apparently they have a pact that whenever one is mistaken for the other, they sign the autograph for whoever the person thinks it is. So if Alan Bennett's asked to sign a painting by David Hockney, he signs it as David Hockney, and Alan Bennett does the same for, you know. So they're just, and the thing with Alan Bennett, like, he's so sort of cuddly and cozy, but it's tough. It's like loads of like hot sex in his books and his plays, and of course his talking heads are amazing as well. So Alan Bennett's somebody, you know, I can see why the LRB have produced his diaries every year for so many years. Although this was the first year he didn't do it, actually, because he said he's really kind of an indoor life now. He just didn't feel he had something he wanted to write about. But yeah, there's just I love the way he writes about his parents. I think that's really beautiful. There was something I thought Marky Smith, I don't know if you know, like The Fall at all, right? But I read one of his biographies, Renegade. And he said, rebelling against your parents, he said, is a middle-class thing. He said, working-class people love their parents because they know how much they had to do for them. And Alan Bennett's like that. You know, his depiction of his mother and his father is just so loving. And it's beautiful. But his diaries are so warm and funny. And Hockney's good as well. If you ever read a book of his interviews with Martin Gayford, they're brilliant. On Creative Practice, they're amazing. A Bigger Conversation. That's an amazing book.
Ronan, I'm going to ask you a question that you are going to answer, which is great. It's about something you'd leave in the house to burn. And what would that be?
So I'd have two things. I'd have any AI translation. I'm an AI skeptic, shall we say. And I think it's really distasteful that people in the technology world who don't read books and have no interest, they congratulate themselves on their creativity, but they've no interest in artistic creativity at all whatsoever. They never discuss novels. They don't read them. They don't care about them. And I have such respect for translators, and that they've landed on AI translation as a way of kind of, don't get me wrong, I think it's brilliant to be able to use, you know, Google Translate when you're traveling and to communicate with people. It's very helpful. But, you know, the idea that without any respect for the art of translation, that they would just try and pass off these very basic formulaic ones. The other one I'd put is The Last Tycoon by I was going to say The Last Tycoon by The Great Gatsby. The Last Tycoon, Last Tycoon by F. Scott Fitzgerald. And the reason I'm putting it in is getting back to Coolock Library. You know, when I was back 12, 13 and just randomly picking up books, not really knowing anything about them. I might have heard his name. Maybe I thought it was F. Scott Fitzgerald and John F. Kennedy were the same person or something like that. And I took the book and I got to the end of it and it's not finished. It's like an unfinished novel. I'm like, how dare they? I know I didn't pay for this book, but I invested my week's reading and I got to thinking I was going to finish the book and it said it was left unfinished. So I was like, burn that book.
Burn it
because it annoyed me but mainly because I have mixed feelings about this idea of writers' unfinished work being published, with the exception of Kafka, because we would have nothing of Kafka if his wishes were respected to burn his books. But there's some stuff coming up from Gabriel Garcia Marquez now. You know, if you're a writer, it's a sensitive thing. You want to make sure something comes out in the world when you're happy with it. And the thought that your stuff is coming out or that you're not finished with being published, I think is... So by saying that, that's no disrespect to F. Scott Fitzgerald. I was really enjoying the bits he wrote. But I just think it's kind of unfair to him that it ended up being published, after he died and he didn't have a chance to finish it or say he was happy with it.
Can you imagine if any of your first drafts or any of your half-finished things now, like after your death, and someone decides to publish them? Can you imagine? God, well, you'd be dead. You won't care. You won't be mortified. But like, yeah.
Well, I would haunt people who did that. I definitely would. I would find a way. And it probably is, because all you need is somebody's Google credentials and sure it's all in your Google Drive and it's all backed up in emails or whatever. So it probably can be. You're asking me before, if there's anything of my own I would burn. Before I had Leonard Nugent Paul published, I kind of had a few short stories published. And I kind of just wrote them because I just thought my cover letter would be light. Now, they're okay, but I was learning and I'm not that happy with them. And actually, there's one I kind of want to revisit and redo. Because it's a short story, but it's actually more of a joke. It's actually kind of a joke, a long joke. It's called 5 Second Rule. And the idea is, this guy is going out with a woman and they're on a date and his food drops on the ground. He picks it up and he eats it and says, 5 Second Rule. And she's disgusted. So she breaks up with him. He goes out with his friend to, commiserate. His friend drops food on the ground, picks it up. And he goes, he picks it up and goes, you can still eat it. 5 Second Rule. So he's sure, eats the 5 Second Rule, eats the thing and immediately passes out because an anaphylactic shock passes out. The guy has to bring his friend to hospital and the paramedic saying, what happened to him? I don't know, because he's embarrassed about the 5 Second Rule. The guy goes into the hospital. They have to actually remove part of his intestines, back to intestines again. And there's nobody there, no family. So he's in the gallery. He has to be there watching it, And as they're passing the new intestine, the doctor drops the piece of intestine and the surgeon picks it up and says, don't worry, it's okay. 5 Second Rule. So basically just that joke in a story.
My last question is, do you have animals, by the way, before I start this? Do you have animals? Do you have dogs or cats or no?
Oh, my wife has allergies, so we don't have anything.
You don't have anything living there. Okay, so that makes it easier because I normally say you can't choose a pet for this question because everyone always says, my cat or my dog or my rabbit or whatever. Yeah. So no people, no animals, but what would you say if that's not a book from your house if it was on fire?
I remember Ricky Gervais was asked a similar question and he said, if I could save two things in a fire, I said, I'd take my guitar and one of the twins. But so for me, actually, I should probably say my guitar. Actually, I didn't think of, the guitar. I was going to say art because I like art, right? I like art. And when Panenka came out, I bought a painting, Purple Bow, by Janos Husti, who's the Hungarian artist who's I contacted for the cover for Panenka. So I think if I get a lot out of art. I only realized actually, because I have a few bits and pieces around the walls, I think when you go, because otherwise I've experienced art in galleries. And I think the thing about galleries, I don't think art is meant to be consumed in that mass way and as briefly. I think a painting is best looked at over and over again, over time, and you eventually start to, get more out of it beyond just the visual. You start to sort of see things and feel things about it. So I think that's why I'd like to bring a painting. But if I could also bring the guitar, I'd have to go to the attic to get it because I don't really play it anymore. But if I time, it would seem strange in a fire to to go up to the attic. But if we can suspend disbelief on that, I'd go up. Maybe I should keep the guitar beside the fire extinguisher or something like that.
Perfect.
That would be my probably better answer than the art.
Yeah, you can definitely save your guitar. I also think you should go up to the attic and bring it down anyway and just have it sitting around. That's what I think, because then you might pick it up again. You can't pick it up again if it's not handy. So
Yeah, that's true. And it is nice. My wife, you know, learning piano, and she used to play flute and she did play recorder as well. So it's actually really nice hearing music in the house. You know, if I'm reading and she's practicing or something, it's lovely. It's a nicer thing.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to ask you to tell our listeners a little bit about Ghost Mountain before we finish up, Ronan, and also if you'd read a little bit from us, that would be great. Yeah.
So Ghost Mountain, it's my third novel. It's out at the end of May. And the brief premise, I guess, is that it's about a mountain that appears suddenly and how that affects the lives of the various characters that are affected by it. More generally, I always think with books, there's about with a small A and about with a capital A. So that's what it's about with a small A. As a capital A, it's just about that sort of fragile sense of self that we project into the world. And it's also about, I think, how we're shaped by absences. So it's those two themes that I go splashing around in for about 280 pages. So I'm going to read the first chapter, which is only a page. So that'll just give you a flavour for the setup and the style. It was, in the ordinary sense of the word, a mountain. Emerging from the surrounding unfamous landscape, it was higher than all around it, though not very high. Limpet-shaped, its crest was bare and rounded like a knee. It faced in all directions without preference, as mountains do. It obstructed both light and wind, but so too did it bring out their personalities. Light, accommodating and peaceful, addressed the mountain with shade and contrast, whereas wind, which is never the same twice, often became exercised by it. From one aspect, there appeared to be two hollows, sitting like sunken sockets about halfway up its slope. A third hollow lay between but below the first two, creating what looked like a haunted expression, though the mountain did not, strictly speaking, ever express itself. When the time came to give it a name, it would be called Ghost Mountain because of those hollows. To say that the mountain was this or that, to ascribe it physical or metaphysical characteristics, to describe it in a way that separated it from everything that was not it, these are all habits of the human mind. And so it could justifiably be said that all and any such remarks describe the describer more than Ghost Mountain. Ghost Mountain had no mind. It did not describe itself. It had no self for self-view. Ghost Mountain was Ghost Mountain. All we know is that it appeared yesterday.
You've been listening to the wonderful Ronan Hessian, whose new novel, Ghost Mountain, is out now with Playmouse Books. Join me next time when I'll be talking with author Catherine Dunn. See you all then.